session of March 9, 1977. I'll begin with a new figure. I called it coupling, pairing. I say pairing, not couple. This trait of living together is not about the conjugal or the pseudo-conjugal couple, even though that kind of couple presents a real problem for living together. I refer to the coupling of two partners who are linked or cemented by a form of mutual alienation. That is a shared madness, folie à deux. I'll just give you a sort of introduction, fleeting terms that you could complete. To begin, I'll give you a few remarks about a light kind of pairing and then a strong or structured pairing. The principle of pairing has been given by Billon. I already mentioned him. Billon, B-I-O-N. I talked about his basic assumption. His main hypothesis is about groups. The basic assumption of coupling or pairing. He writes about groups that just meet for a psychoanalytic session. Two members of the group would become involved in the discussion. Sometimes the exchange between the two could hardly be described, but it would be evident that they were involved with each other. They were partners, and the whole group thought so too. He goes on. Whenever two people begin to have this kind of relationship in a group, in a session, whether these two are man and woman, man and man, it seems to be a basic assumption held by both the group and the pair concerned that their relationship is a sexual one. It is as if there could be no reason for two people's coming together except sex. Here, what is described is the configuring, the provisional arrangement of the elements in a group. Fleeting, transitory, yet generalized and recurrent. You can see this by yourselves. There is a light enclosure in any party or group of a pair of individuals animated by a warm relation of mutual interpolation, or maybe mutual seduction. It isolates them. They stand slightly apart. Regardless of the motive, the setting, the excuse, there is a certain form of unsettling, an agitation, and there are onlookers who see this unsettling moment. This ruptures the group for a moment, for a short while. It's the beginning of the madness shared by two, folie à deux. We should play on the opposition between affolement and folie, that is, agitation and madness. This isn't relevant in psychoanalysis, the notion of affolement. If psychoanalysis never spoke of this, is that this agitation belongs to something very subtle, that we spend our lives getting agitated by someone, by something. We are maddened, in a sense, by one or by the other. Now, I'll give two examples of strong pairing. The first one, I take it from the Losiac history. I've already mentioned it. It's the story of Eulogius and the cripple. I'll read a section of it. Here it is. It's the story of Eulogius, who had been converted. He was well educated in the humanities. Inspired with the love of immortality, he had parted with the excitement of the world and disposed of everything, keeping a little money for himself, as he was not able to work. Bored, not wishing to enter a community, one day he found someone lying in the marketplace, a cripple who had neither feet nor hands, only his tongue was still functioning, served as a contact with passers-by. Eulogius stood and looked intently at him. He prayed to God and made a compact with him. Lord, in your name, I will take this crippled man, I will look after him until death, so that I may be saved through him. Graciously, grant me to endure this undertaking. And he approached the cripple, told him, would you like me, sir, to take you into my house and take care of you? He replied, certainly I would. I'll fetch my mule and I'll take you. It was agreed. He brought the mule, took him to his cell, looked after him. For 15 years, the cripple lived under Eulogius' care. Eulogius, with his hands, washed him, looked after him. After 15 years, a demon assailed the cripple, and he turned against Eulogius. The cripple started abusing Eulogius with foul talk and blasphemy, adding insult to injury. Assassin, deserter, you steal what belongs to others. You wish to be saved through caring for me. Throw me into the marketplace. It is meat I crave. Eulogius brought him meat. Again he called, I'm not satisfied. Crowds are what I need. I want to go back to the marketplace. What violence? Take me back where you found me. Had he had hands to do so, he would have choked Eulogius so much the demon exasperated him. Eulogius went off to the ascetics nearby and said, "What should I do? The cripple has led me to despair. Shall I throw him out? I made an oath to God and I fear for myself. But should I not cast him out? I am at a loss to know what to do." Then they said, "Ask the Great One," for this is how they call Anthony. "Go to him, take the cripple on a boat, bring him to the monastery. Wait until the Great One comes out of his cave, put the case to him. Whatever he tells you, follow his decision. God speaks to you through him." He agreed with them, put the cripple on the bark, took him to the monastery's Anthony's disciples. He said, "I found this cripple in the marketplace. I made an oath to God. I would care for him and be saved through him. But now he has been seized by the devil, and I don't know what to do." After so many years, what should I do? Should I cast him out? What can you do for me? Anthony addressed him in a dignified and austere manner. "You would cast him out, but he who made him would not cast him out. You cast him out, God will raise a finer man than you, and he will gather him up." Eulogius kept his peace and cowered. Anthony left him and began to lash the cripple verbally, to rail against him. "You crippled, maimed, unworthy of either earth or heaven, why do you not stop fighting against God himself? Do you not realize it is Christ who is your servant? How dare you utter such things against Christ? Did this man not make himself your servant because of Christ?" He was harsh to him, and then he left off. When he had finished, he resumed conversation with the Eulogius, the cripple, together in this way. "Do not tarry here. Go. Do not separate from each other, except in the cell which you have shared for so long a time. God is even now calling for you. This temptation has come your way as you are both near death and will be judged worthy to be crowned. Therefore, do nothing else, so that the angel may not find you here when he comes." Quickly, they made the journey back to the cell, and in 40 days, Eulogius died, and in 3 days more, the cripple also died. That's then another coupling in post that has something similar in Swann's Way, Françoise and Aunt Léonie. It's in the first volume in the Pléiade edition. I will read this for you. Françoise has to take care of Aunt Léonie. She spends her time introducing imaginary worries. She would beguile herself with a sudden pretense that Françoise had been robbing her, that she had set a trap to make certain and had caught her betrayer red-handed, and being in the habit, when she made up a game of cards by herself, of playing her own and adversary's hands at once, she would first stammer out Françoise's awkward excuses and then reply to them with such a fiery indignation that any one of us who happened to intrude upon her at one of these moments would find her bathed in perspiration, her eyes blazing, her false hair askew, exposing the baldness of her brows. Françoise must often, from the next room, have heard these modern sarcasms leveled at herself, the mere framing of which in words would not have relieved my aunt's feelings sufficiently had they been allowed to remain in a purely immaterial form without the degree of substance and reality which she added to them by muttering them half aloud. Sometimes, however, even these counterpane dramas would not satisfy my aunt. She must see her work staged, and so on a Sunday, with all the door mysteriously closed, she would confide to Eulalie a doubt of Francois' integrity, a determination to be rid of her, and another time she would confide to Francois her suspicions of the disloyalty of Eulalie, to whom the front door would be soon be closed for good. A few days later, she would be sick of her latest confidant once more, as thick as thieves with the traitor. But before the next performance, the two would yet again have changed roles, that the suspicion which Eulalie might occasionally arouse in her were no more than a flash in a pan, that soon subsided for lack of fuel, since Eulalie was not living with her in the house. It was a different matter in the case of Françoise, of whose presence under the same roof as herself, my aunt, was perpetually conscious, though for fear of catching cold, were she to leave her bed, she never dared to go down in the kitchen to establish whether or not there were any grounds for her suspicions. Gradually, her mind came to be exclusively occupied with trying to guess what Françoise might at any given moment be doing behind her back. She would detect a furtive look on Françoise's face, something contradictory in what she said, some desire which she appeared to be concealing, and then she would show her that she was unmasked with a single word, which made Françoise turn pale, and which my aunt seemed to find a cruel satisfaction in driving deep into her poor servant's heart. And so, by degrees, Françoise and my aunt, the quarry and the hunter, had reached the point of constantly trying to forestall each other's ruses. My mother was afraid lest Françoise should develop a genuine hatred of my aunt, who did everything in her power to hurt her. However that might be, Françoise had come more and more to pay an infinitely scrupulous attention to my aunt's least word and gesture. When she had to ask her anything, she would hesitate for a long time over how best to go about it. But when she had uttered her request, she would watch my aunt covertly, trying to guess from the expression on her face what she thought of it and how she would reply. And so it was that, whereas an artist who, reading the memoirs of the 17th century, wishing to bring himself nearer to the great Louis, considered that he's making progress in that direction by constructing a pedigree that traces his own descent from some historic family, or by engaging in correspondence with one of the reigning sovereigns of Europe, is actually turning his back on what he mistakenly seeks under identical and therefore moribund forms, an elderly provincial lady, by doing no more than yielding wholeheartedly to her own irresistible eccentricities and a cruelty born of idleness could see. Without ever having given a thought to Louis XIV, the most trivial occupation of her daily life, a morning toilet, a lunch, an afternoon nap, assumed, by virtue of the despotic singularity, something of the interest that was to be found in what Saint-Simon called the mechanics of life at Versailles, and was able to persuade herself that her silences, a suggestion of good humor or haughtiness on her features, would provide Françoise with matter for a mental commentary as intense with passions and terror as did the silence, the good humor, or the haughtiness of the king when a courtier and even his greatest nobles had presented a petition to him in an avenue at Versailles. We see here a common structure in both those instances of maddening folie à deux. In one case, you have the idleness of one in the pair. In Aunt Léonie, we have total inaction. There's nothing, no events, prostration. Eulogius similarly sells all his possessions, gives them away, retains a small income because he doesn't want to work. Then, second common feature, there is the anxious, difficult, capricious personality of one in the couple. eulogious complaints wherever he is. At the beginning, he's not happy anywhere, he's not happy in a group, he's not happy alone. The cripple is never happy. He wants meat, he wants people around him. In that folie à deux, we see that we have troublesome, spoiled children. In my childhood, in the southwest of France, there was a term in my patois, or maybe I invented it, to refer to spoilt and difficult children. There were children who were called chaochun. Chaochun children. The third feature is that in both cases, you have a certain physical inertia of one in the pair. Leonie is in bed. She can't go to the kitchen. The cripple has no hands, no legs. He's a sort of object carried. There is, in fourth feature, a nurse-patient anaclitic relation. One of the pair is dependent upon the other. They've relinquished their body. There is a daily contact on the bodily level. One has to care for the other, to wash the other, to feed the other. Fifth feature. In both cases, there is an intense linguistic relationship. The cripple is extremely talkative. Leonie shows a continuous spurt of interior monologue. At times, she speaks out loud. Six, there is a binding cohabitation contract. Françoise is a servant for life. There is a feudal devotion linking her to the mistress. Eulogius has made a solemn contract before God that he will take care of the cripple, and that's his problem. He cannot undo the contract. And then seventh, you have verbal attacks, explosions, outbreaks, outbursts. They try to wound each other. They try to come up with accusations that will hurt the other most. That Françoise is a thief, that Eulogius just wants to save his soul on the back of a cripple. Finally, the eighth feature, the only possible denouement is death. This is indeed this strange case of the folie à deux. In how many households, families, will you have this, even in couples, this mother-daughter mixture of hate and love? It is an inextricable mixture of hate and love. And at the death of Aunt Leonie, Françoise exhibits the wildest grief. There's a total ambivalence here. This is an archetypal relation. It's the quarry and the hunter, as Proust says, or the victim and the executioner. We would find this in Saad or Dostoevsky. The roles can be reversed. This is about coupling. I'll come now to another figure, which is distance. Living together, especially idiorhythmic living together, implies a physics or an ethics of distance between cohabitating subjects. This is a formidable problem, the fundamental problem of living together. We'll approach this problem only through fragments, through partial indirect themes. I'll briefly set out one of the forms the problem can take. It's the distance between bodies in the living together experience. This problem can be formulated as an aporia, that is, no entry. This aporia is a chain. First, I find the bodies of another person unsettling. I desire. I experience the energy and the absence of desire. I engage in the exhausting strategies of desire. Secondly, from my confusion, I infer, I fantasize a state that ought to make it go away. I could use the patristic word hesukia, hesukia, that is respite from desire, a vacancy without distress, equanimity. Third point. I then set out rules that would enable me to achieve hesukia. Generally speaking, there are rules of distance with respect to other bodies. Fourth, but by extinguishing my desire for other, I simply extinguish the desire to live. If I'm not troubled or unsettled by the other's body, if I can never touch anyone else, what's the point of living? The aporia is closed. In the Christian monastic system, the subject, it seems obvious to me, stops at number 3, the rules of distance. The subject breaks the chain at the right moment. He appears to the religious telos, the desire for perfection. He changes desire, he switches to a different desire. If he doesn't redirect his desire, or reach another desire, then he falls into this horrible state I have analyzed, acedia. Acedia is falling between two desires. Hence, the meticulous rigor of the monastic rules with respect to distances between bodies. The monastic rules have regulated distances with the utmost precision. Before giving you those rules, it's worth making finer distinctions between, on the one hand, the depreciative ideology of the body, typical of Christianity, aiming at killing the body. The fathers of the church, they want to dematerialize the body, disdain the body, punish the body. Distinguish this from something different, the rules of distance. The rules of distance are rules, and I interpret a little, are propedeutic rules that redirect desire. They try to suspend desire. There is an epoche, a suspension of judgment that is also a provisional suspension of desire. To suspend is not to abolish. Those rules of distance are so specific that they are formulated in spatial, metrical terms. For instance, about sleep for the monks, we have extremely detailed prescriptions. Pachomius, who founded the first monastery, prohibits two monks from sleeping together in the same cell. They have to sleep in separate beds. We find this in Saint Benedict, chapter 22. The youngest brothers are not to sleep in beds next to each other, but between the elders. This is obviously the exact opposite of what is described in Plato's Symposium, where we have an exchange of positions of the partners in beds where they are eating and drinking that is wholly eroticized. Then, among the prescriptions, the body has to be completely isolated, meticulously enveloped by distance. These are Pachomius' rules. Here is the Latin. I give you the Latin as I pronounced when I was at school. Totum corpus nemo unguet nisi causa infirmitatis. Nobody covers the body if it is not for some disease. Nec lavabitur aqua nudo corpore. Nobody will wash a naked body with water. Nullus lavare alterum poterit aut ungere. Nemo alteri loquatur in tenebris. Nobody can wash another one. Nobody will speak to another in darkness. Manum alterius ne teneat, sed sive stererit, sive ambulaverit, uno cubito distet ab altero. That nobody holds the hand of the other, but whether he's quiet or walks, he should remain at a certain distance of the other in the bedroom. What I find remarkable about those interdictions is the subtle sense of the path of desire. You have everything about desire, from autoeroticism, washing naked, spending hours in a shower, caresses, to wash someone else. There is an articulation between anacletism and erotic pleasure. The source, of course, is the mother caring for a newborn baby. there is an erotic function, an erotic side. Talking without being able to see the person you're talking to. This is the intense eroticism of language at nighttime. There is a strategic play of distances, always keeping the other at an arm's length. You have in life and in the novels about life a manual of the pleasures of contact, of brushing up against. Nemo ungues. The real satisfaction is brushing up against. It's not a genital satisfaction, but the attempt at relieving a frustration. You have people who, in the metro, try to brush against you. This is a perversion. I can prove to myself that this body is not forbidden if I touch it. The other's body is not prohibited. You have this in Proust in a scene of Charlus and the narrator. Charlus caresses the chin of the narrator. And the narrator speaks of the fingers of a hairdresser. What is the best of distances? There is an investment in an activity, a labor of distanciation in the place where the monks sleep. Pacôme says that the monk should sleep upright on low seats, rather than lying flat. For Saint Benedict, there should be lights in the dormitory until morning. There should be a belt. There is a symbolism of the belt. For Saint Basil, the monks have a tunic with a belt, which is a sign of virility. The belt has this religious symbolism. In Job, you have this, gird up thy loins like a man. We could see today, even today, how the belt is a symbol of virility. You have those big leather belts. You're dressing like cowboys. What is even more relevant in fashion, that braces are totally discredited, no longer in fashion. Braces are a symbol of non-virility, loss of virility. In sum, we have a set of rules. That show an enormous science of desire. There is an opposition between the thematic of sensuousness of voluptuity, the skin, language, what is, we are reminded of the child's polymorphous perversion, the erotic activity of the child, the caresses of the mother. And then you have the thematics of the muscles, of tensions, of the loins, as the origin of genital movements. You have to control voluptuousness and sensuousness. To finish, to bring things to a close but not conclude, on about distance, two notes. Wilhelm Reich talks about the theme of the body as armor. How to let go of the body's armor. You have some drugs that have the effect, the yellow pills, that are not aphrodisiacs, but help you come out of your shell. They produce a certain state in which the body gets rid of the armor. You have these drugs that de-armorize the body. About the control over the body's eroticism. In Christian culture, the solution is generally it's a sort of basic idea, a mutilation, a castration. It's a fantasy of castration. Go back to the Losiac history of this monk, Elias, who took great interest in the welfare of virgins. He had to teach at a monastery in which you had 300 women. To prevent the women from quarreling, he has to go and live among them. He is therefore very tormented. One night, he dreams that he has been castrated. When he wakes up, he is cured of all passion. But in the Orient, as much as we know, the Tao, it never instituted anything. In its anecdotes, it makes you see the existence of a non-mutilating form of control. You see this in the coitus reservatus. This presupposes a completely different philosophy of the orgasm than that of the very Occidental Wilhelm Reich. The orgasm isn't the sovereign good, it's a deeply considered theory of perverse sexuality. It is deep because it comes close to a certain utopia, the utopia of non-repression, which is the figure of the child, the absolutely utopian figure of humanity in the grips of repression. The child is, of course, a polymorphous pervert, as Freud would say. The eros of a child cannot be enclosed. Here's what I would add. Now, about a completely different topic. I'll talk about servants. In human beings, we have needs and desires. Living together is a field of desire. Idiorhythmy is the subtle, non-scientific, notionally or ineffectually institutionalized form of that desire. But alongside that desire, what happens to needs? How do needs get satisfied? Who takes care of domestic tasks in any community? This is the thorny issue in modern communes that have started about 10 years ago. The question is always, who does the washing up? This is the problem of servants. In civilization where slavery dominates, needs are automatically distinguished from desires. We see this in the description of the living together in ancient Greek society. The oikia, the community, the house, as described by Xenophon in his Economicus, is an hierarchical and functionalist community. You have communities in which the satisfaction of needs and the accomplishment of desire are treated together. In idiorhythmic communities, you have no form of domesticity. The contemplative subject is responsible for meeting his needs, which he reduces to a bare minimum. All the monks, the Oriental monks, in Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Constantinople, came from the peasant classes. They were no intellectuals. They had no culture, or they would reject culture. Saint Anthony refuses to study so as to avoid being corrupted by culture. There is a certain anti-intellectualism of this marginality. Each anachorite is responsible for the totality of his needs. At times, there is a young disciple, a famulus, who plays the role of a servant, or maybe more, a courier. This enables the elder man to remain in reclusion. In such cases, the exchange, sublimated domesticity, it is a living together, in fact, that is living together with a slave. We see this in Robinson Crusoe. It calls up the world of slavery. Robinson is connected with the traffics of slaves to Brazil. The first word taught by Robinson to Friday is master. Then he teaches English to him, but Friday doesn't teach his language to Crusoe. Friday is almost as well dressed as his master. Prior to the shipwreck, Robinson was himself the slave of a pirate. He had a friendship with Souris, a young boy. this arrangement had all the appearances of a famulus. The experience in exchange for services. But in fact, when it comes to it, it's totally different. In the end, Robinson sells him. Zuri was indeed a slave. About the Mount Athos, we've seen two sorts of hydrorhythmy, one old, one on the pure model of eremitic monks, and another model that incorporates social divisions. You had wealthy monks with a source of income and other monks who were servants. These monks are assigned to domestic tasks. Originally, at Athos, there was idiorhythmy without servants. Even there was a rule prohibited servants. This has to be connected with a feature of Athos that is misunderstood, the rule prohibiting access to female animals. This prohibition was introduced by Saint Athanasius. Apparently, this rule had nothing to do with sexual morality. The interdiction of having female animals. It relates to the rule prohibiting servants. The issue was to prevent monasteries from living off income earned from herds that would be tended by female servants, wage servants. Once you have herds, you have to have slaves of servants. So you need only male monks, male animals. We see this in the mysterious island. The five colonizers assigned the task of tending the herd to the condemned Ayrton, whom they found on another island. You have no distinction between needs and desire here, but in other cases, this distinction is observed. There is a functional group that has to take care of the tasks of everyday life. In Cenobitic monasteries, you have the converts, the convertiti, the converted. It's the price of conversion, the price paid for integration, to be the servants. One enters into the game of social division. We saw this with the Carthusian, the brothers of the low house, the fathers of the high house. In the Buddhist monasteries of Ceylon, a moderate Buddhism, a soft Buddhism, in those Buddhist monasteries, monks are relieved of their daily tasks by a team of domestic staff. There were, for instance, old people with no profession and no family who chose to end the days doing small domestic tasks, the upasaka, or by teenagers, adolescents, who saw the way of financing their studies, or by wage servants paid for by laymen. The communitary problem repeats the major structural problems of all societies: the division of labor, exchange, class divisions, the reconstruction of a social microcosm at the margin of society, the circumscription of an idle privileged group. What I find more interesting is the internal structuring within the two groups, masters versus servants. I'd say it's structure of reproduction, of imitation, of duplication, of anamorphosis. The masters are reflected in the servants, but it's a distorted, lacunary image. The family, the converse, are just a mirror image, the uneducated versions of the solitaires, of the incomparable fathers. The convertiti are only recently converted. They are forcing themselves to mimic the status of the group they wish to join. We see this in Zola's novel Pobouille, this game of farcical duplication with an element of parody in the communal space that is the apartment building of Potluck. There are two types of human being: the bourgeois, the masters. They have the grand apartment. And then you have the servants who have the attic rooms or live in the kitchens. There you have the adultery in between. In Zola, you see the mirror images, the replications, the speech of the masters, and when the servants speak to each other, you have a farcical reproduction of the master's speech. Since you have the mistress, you have the kept mistress, her interior reproduces exactly the room of the wife. There is a piano in both rooms. I will end with this. I just open a huge file here. Any social division implies a mirror image. Every division implies the mirror, whence the mirroring effects of the divisions in the social field. We have to work on mirror images in social division. Thank you for your attention.